Welcome to the Amazon Web Services Podcast, hosted by Simon Alicia and Simone Brunozzi. This is your regular insight into the world of AWS with service updates, architecture discussions, and technical tips. You can contact us on our website, aws.amazon.com/podcast, by email at awspodcast@amazon.com, and on Twitter at @AWSPodcast. Hello again, everyone, and welcome to the AWS podcast. Great to have you on board. Always great to have our faithful listeners listening and sharing what they're doing. My name is Simon Alicia, Principal Solution Architect here at Amazon in Australia. And joining me, as always, my illustrious podcast partner, Simone Brunozzi.
Yes. Hi, Simon. This is Simone Brunozzi, based in San Francisco, California, and a technology evangelist for Amazon Web Services. Wow, we have a lot to do today, right?
Lots to do today. What do you reckon we should start with today, Simone?
So we start with the cores.
Cores, okay. Perhaps some of our listeners might not know exactly what cores is. Let's dive in and give them an intro, hey?
Sure.
So why do we need cores? Well, in order to keep your content safe, your web browser implements something called same origin policy. And the default policy ensures that the scripts and other active content loaded from one site or domain cannot interfere or interact with the content from another location without an explicit indication that this is the desired behavior.
And of course, however, in certain cases, the developer of the original page might have legitimate reasons to write code that interacts with content or services at other locations. So CORS, and we will tell you the acronym, which is Cross-Origin Resource Sharing. CORS provides the mechanism to allow the developer to tell the browser to allow this interaction. It seems confusing, but it is quite simple, in fact. Essentially, you want to let a developer specify that that content taken from another site can be used within that page safely. So back on track, Amazon S3 now supports cross-origin resource sharing, also known as CORS. So the CORS specification gives you the ability to build web applications that make requests to domains other than the one which supplied the primary content.
Yeah, it's pretty cool because you can use CORS support to build web applications that use JavaScript and HTML5 to interact directly with the resources in Amazon S3 without the need for a proxy server. So you can implement HTML5 drag and drop uploads to Amazon S3. You can show upload progress or update content directly from your web applications.
So as an example, external web pages, style sheets, and HTML5 applications hosted in different domains or even fonts, for example, can now reference assets such as web fonts and images stored in an S3 bucket, enabling you to share these assets across multiple websites. So, Simon, how can AWS customers take real advantage of this new feature?
Okay, let's get to the guts of it. Here it is. So here's how you do it. You can configure any of your S3 buckets for cross-domain access through the AWS Management Console or, surprise, surprise, the S3 API. And you do this by adding one or more CORS rules to your bucket. Each rule can specify a domain that should have access to your bucket, for example, www.mysite.com, and a set of HTTP verbs you wish to allow, for example, put. I'm sure that customers welcome this new feature, Simone, don't you think?
Yeah, actually, third-party developers and products are all excited about it. For example, there is already a new version of a freeware called the S3 Browser, which supports CORS configuration. And, of course, you can get the link on the show notes. And I also catched a nice comment on the AWS blog the other day. So the comment was posted by Benjamin Coe, and he said, "I just finished porting our Chrome extension over to using CORS and HTML5 for uploading. Awesome, thanks," and a link to the description of what it did. So I think
very
that
nice.
Customers really loved this feature.
Very, very nice.
Now, I think it's time to move to item number 2 for today's podcast. We have a few to cover, and so we have to be quite quick. So Amazon DynamoDB, actually, Simon, I think it would be useful to just give a quick description of what Amazon DynamoDB is before we describe the new feature.
For sure. So DynamoDB is what's called a NoSQL database, so it doesn't operate in a relational format. It's a more loose format, and it allows users to easily access a database that is highly resilient, very performant. You could specify the provision throughput that you'd like. And it's one of those really cool capabilities or services that delivers a lot of flexibility with a lot of simplicity. So if you're doing anything that requires high transaction rates or very low latency, DynamoDB is something certainly worth looking at.
Perfect. So very recently, we added support for binary data. So if you are a DynamoDB user, you already know the drill. You create a table, provision the throughput in terms of read and write capacity units per second, and then you start storing and retrieving data without worrying about hitting storage or performance limits, or even reprovisioning, for example, throughput as needed in response to changes in the size, scale, or needs of your application. So to date, DynamoDB has focused on storing numeric or string data, and of course numeric sets and string sets. And because many customers, including I guess you that you're listening now to us, are using DynamoDB in so many diverse ways, we know that an additional flexibility such as support for binary data is really important.
Exactly. And the nice news, and I use DynamoDB myself, is that you can now store binary data in DynamoDB without having to convert it into a string. You can also store sets composed of binary data. This change will result in greater storage efficiency, along with the potential for lower storage and I/O costs for you. If you're storing binary data of any appreciable size, the increased storage efficiency may very well let you read and write the data with fewer provisioned capacity units.
So this new functionality is available now in all of the regions where DynamoDB is supported. And you can see our products and services by region grid for details. Of course, you will need to update to the latest version of the appropriate AWS SDK in order to start storing and retrieving binary data. For example, if you use the put item method in the AWS SDK for PHP, now you can accept binary and binary set attributes for the item.
Very nice. Now, DynamoDB's integration with Elastic MapReduce, for example, to perform backups or queries through Hive, doesn't currently support binary data types. We're working on this now, and we'll release it as soon as it's ready.
Very cool. Now I think it's time for item number three. I will let you introduce it, Simon.
Absolutely. This is a big one for a lot of our customers. This is cost allocation for customer bills. Now, let's talk about this. So when you have growth challenges, you need to think about what's going to happen over time. And you probably know that when you put Amazon Web Services to work for your company, you start small. So you have one Amazon S3 bucket for some backups, or an Amazon EC2 instance hosting a single website or web application. You know, things work out pretty well, and before you know it, word of your success spreads to your team, and they start using it too. And at some point, the entire company jumps on board, and you become yet another AWS success story.
Nice, but of course, as your usage of AWS grows, you stop charging it to your personal credit card, and you create an account for your company. Then you use IAM, or Identity and Access Management, to control access to the AWS resources created and referenced by each of the applications, but
There's one catch, and with all these departments, developers, and applications making use of AWS from a single account, allocating the costs of projects into budgets can be difficult, because previously we didn't give you the necessary information. And some of our customers have told us that this cost allocation process can consume several hours of their time each month. So now we've introduced cost allocation via tagging. And this extends the existing EC2 tagging system, which is made up of keys and values. And we spoke about this in one of our earliest podcasts. We are launching a new cost allocation system to make it easy for you to tag your AWS resources and to access billing data that is broken down by tag or tags.
So, for example, with this release, you can tag the following types of AWS resources for cost allocation purposes: S3 buckets, EC2 instances, and of course, EBS volumes, reserved instances, if you bought any, or even spot instance requests, VPN connections, the Amazon RDS database instances, and last but not least, the AWS CloudFormation stacks.
Now, we're planning to make this feature even more useful over time. We want to give you the ability to tag more types of AWS resources. And we're thinking about allowing you to use more than 10 tags per resource. We also want to include the upfront fee for reserved instance purchases. And your suggestions for other features are always welcome too, as they are for everything.
Nice. So it's now let's get to item number four for today's podcast. This is something actually pretty interesting. It's the Amazon EC2 Reserved Instance Marketplace.
Nifty.
So, yeah, this is really nice. So as many customers know, but let's have a refresher here just for the ones that don't. If you want to get EC2 instances, if you want to use them, there are essentially three options to choose from. The first one is you can buy instances on demand. So you pay for compute capacity by the hour, with no upfront fees or long-term commitments. On-demand instances are recommended for situations where you don't know how much, if any, compute capacity you will need at a given time.
Yeah, but if you know that you will need a certain amount of capacity, you can buy an EC2 reserved instance. You make a low one-time upfront payment, reserve it for a 1 or 3 year term, and pay a significantly lower hourly rate. And you can choose between light utilization, medium utilization, and heavy utilization reserved instances to further align your costs with your usage.
And of course, the third option is that you can bid for unused EC2 capacity on the spot market with a maximum hourly price you are willing to pay for a particular instance type in the region and availability zone of your choice. And of course, when the current spot price of the desired instance type is at your price or below the price you set, your application will run.
Very nice. Now, we're increasing the flexibility of the EC2 reserved instance model even more with the introduction of the reserved instance marketplace. So if you have excess capacity, you can list it on the marketplace and sell it to someone who needs additional capacity. If you need additional capacity, you can compare the upfront prices and durations of reserved instances on the marketplace to the upfront prices of 1 and 3 year reserved instances available directly from AWS.
And then, of course, the reserved instances in the marketplace are functionally identical to other reserved instances and have the then current hourly rates. They will just have less than a full term and, of course, a different upfront price. So transactions in the marketplace are always between a buyer and a seller. The reserved instance marketplace hosts the listings and allows buyers and sellers to locate and transact with each other. And then, of course, you can use this newfound flexibility in a variety of ways, I'm sure. So, Simon, let's throw some ideas together. What customers, what can they do with this new feature?
So let me give you one idea. You can switch instance types. So if you find that your application is put on a little weight and happens to the best of us, we all get a little bigger over time, and you need a larger instance type, you can sell the old RIs and buy new ones from the marketplace or from AWS. This also applies to situations where we introduce a new instance type that is a better match for your requirements.
Nice. Another idea could be, for example, to buy reserved instances on the marketplace for your medium-term needs. Perhaps you are running a cost-sensitive marketing promotion that will last for 60, 90 days. Then you can purchase the reserved instances, which we sometimes call RIs. Use it until the promotion is over and then sell it. You'll benefit from the RI pricing without the need to own them for the full 1 year or even 3 year term. So you can keep the RIs as long as they continue to save you money, and then when you don't need them anymore, just sell them.
Very nice. Another thing you can do is you can relocate. Perhaps you started to run your application in one AWS region, only to find later that another one would be a better fit for the majority of your customers. Again, sell the old ones, buy the new ones.
In short, you get the pricing benefit of reserved instances and the flexibility to make changes as your application and your business evolves, grows, or sometimes, perish the thought, shrinks.
Indeed. And look, it's always great to see AWS innovate, not just on technology, but also on business model costs and making things even more flexible.
So on the show notes, we have a few links for you, of course. And we also added a nice blog post by Eric Hammond on his Elastic.com blog, where there is very good advice on how to save money with the reserve instance marketplace. So Sam, I think we are at the end of our show. As usual, we really want our listeners to provide feedback so they can send us an email to awspodcast@amazon.com. They can find us on Twitter. Our handle is AWS Podcast. And Simon, what's our website where they can download and access past episodes?
They can always visit aws.amazon.com/podcast. And please share it with your friends, tweet it out, put it on your LinkedIn, let people know that it's out there. We're getting some great feedback that people didn't realize we had this podcast. And once they discover it, they really enjoy it. So please do share it with your friends.
Nice.
Excellent. So goodbye to everyone again for episode number 17, and look forward to seeing you the next time.
Thanks, Simon, and arrivederci.
Thanks for listening to the AWS podcast. We love to get your feedback, so please contact us via our website, aws.amazon.com/podcast, by email at awspodcast@amazon.com, and on Twitter at @AWSPodcast. Background music provided under Creative Commons Attribution 2.5 by Porchcat. Visit ccmixter.org/files/porchcat/3705.